I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News the 2024 winner of the prestigious Hungerford Award. Now, I'm not going to make the mistake of mispronouncing your name, so I'll let you introduce yourself to our listeners.
Sure. My name is Jirka Gelau Weldeyes, but I'm happy when people mispronounce my name, which I want the, you know, to give them the freedom to express my name in their own way of speaking, so no problem.
I know a lot of people just call you Jirka.
Yes, that's fine, yes.
And it's lovely. You can get your tongue around Jirka.
Yeah, Jirka, this R in the middle.
Well, with those who can and those who can't, Australians notoriously have a very flat R, so they probably just say Jirka.
Which sounds good.
It's really lovely to meet you, and as I say, congratulations on winning the Hungerford. It must have been an exciting moment when your name was called out last Thursday night.
Yes, yeah, I'm still buzzing from winning the Hungerford. It's one of the best moments in my life.
Oh. But you're no stranger, Jirka, to winning literary awards. We'll also talk about your academic life and a couple of books that you've been involved in the writing of, one on your own called Native Colonialism.
Yes.
But you've been writing poetry and writing more generally in your home country of Ethiopia for years, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was quite young, from young age, I grew up people who are poets in a traditional way, in the Ethiopian traditional system, which is one of possibly the oldest education system in the world, completely disregarded today and excluded from the modern education system. But there is an indigenous Ethiopian education system from where I gain significant insight about poetry, traditional Ethiopian poetry. So I was just trying to become like those wise sages in Ethiopia, and was writing poems since childhood. I was a boy shepherd going to the field, to the mountain. Our land is mountainous, and with my goats and sheep and cows, I would sit down and write poems and recite poems, and that was my life.
Well, I'm very worried about the animals you were caring for. Did they run away while you were sitting there on the rock writing poetry?
They sometimes come around me and wonder what I'm just babbling about.
I'm guessing that even though the life of a humble shepherd sounds very humble, that your family, I'm guessing your father, grandparents, mother, grandparents, had some knowledge of this traditional language and the poetry of which we're speaking, and you were brought up in a world of that, were you?
Absolutely, because you see, the world we live in was not a world of poverty for me. It was a world of joy and happiness. You know, when teenagers in this country, for instance, when they go and work in McDonald's or some kind of activity, we encourage that. That is a good thing. And for me also, in a world where people cultivate the land and produce their own food and have their own music and culture and writing and worship, going to the field is going for play. We were just running and jumping from one gorge to another, climbing mountains and climbing trees, eating wild fruits, singing all day and playing with our, you know, cattle. That was a life of freedom, and we call it the life of the wind. Children are regarded as wind. So the people treat us as being a wind. You have to be free, and the field is regarded as, you know, that vast place where we can enjoy freedom.
That's a beautiful concept. I've been watching children while I've been on holiday recently in different parts of the world, and they do run free. They're joyful. They're unrestrained. They jump on a chair. They run through a corridor. It's a lovely way to think about children. They're the wind.
Absolutely. I have never experienced a life where a child is kept indoor, because a child in Ethiopia is a child of the community. Every house is like your own home. If you're hungry, you go to your neighbor's house and eat with the other children. So we're all kept and cared by everyone around us.
Now, some of the people listening to this podcast will be familiar generally, or perhaps even in particular with Ethiopia. There'll be some who've been there, who know the things we are talking about, or the places where you've lived, and if you like, the geopolitics of Ethiopia today. But I'm just taken every time I sit and look and think about Ethiopia. Its place in the Horn of Africa, down the bottom right, depending on which way you look at the atlas. You've got Somalia, you've got Eritrea, which used to be part of your country once upon a time, didn't it? And then you've got the rest of Africa going north and west. And yet Ethiopia has been this very independent, self-governing nation for just about ever. So much so that in the late 19th century, at the end of the 1890s, they expelled the Italians who were trying to be colonial overlords.
Yeah.
The Ethiopians overall must be a very proud people.
Absolutely. And I think my book is like a love letter for Ethiopia. It tries to tell the complete radical transformation in Ethiopia in the last 50 years. Now, so many people, when the name Ethiopia is mentioned, they remember hunger, poverty, like, you know, remember the starving Ethiopians, maybe.
And long-distance runners.
Yes, yeah. But there are those real challenges in Ethiopia today which we have to recognize. And my book explains how that happened. How can such a proud country turned out to have so many problems in modern times? So if we go in history, even scientific and anthropological findings show that Ethiopia has this ancient civilization. Greek writers like Homer, Herodotus, and other writers referred to Ethiopia as a land of people who are pious and wise, and people who have everything. If we look at the Bible itself, Ethiopia is mentioned more than 44 times, including where it says Ethiopia stretches out her arms to God.
Can I just interpolate for a moment? I understand that the traditional language of Ethiopia was the fifth language into which the Bible was translated.
The Bible was translated into the Ethiopian language. The ancient translation of the Bible is actually the Gris Bible, the Ethiopian Bible. We call it the Gerima Bible. And the Bible was translated into the Ethiopian language because Ethiopians become Christian more before Europeans become Christian. And Christianity become indigenous to Ethiopia. If you read the Bible in Acts chapter 8, you read a story of how the Ethiopian who went to Jerusalem was baptized by Philip and come back, brought Christianity back to the country. That means the country was so civilized that it was sending missionaries to Jerusalem. And also, if we look at even in Islamic phase, Ethiopia is regarded as a land of justice. When Prophet Muhammad, his family was prosecuted in Mecca, he said, go to the Christian country, Abyssinia, Ethiopia, you will be saved there. And he sent his family. And the Ethiopian king protected the Muslim refugees. And as a result of that, the Prophet said that don't touch the Ethiopians. They are pious and just people. So you have in the country Judaism, which came with the Ark of the Covenant, and also Christianity, which Ethiopia accepted around 300 AD officially, but even started before that, and also Islam. All of these religions lived together.
And Islam's in about the 7th
century. Yeah, the 7th century.
Yes.
And these religions, there has neither been fighting or animosity among religions. On top of that, Ethiopia had around 80 tribes. All of this diversity in a vast land lived together. At the Berlin Conference in 1884, the Europeans divided Africa among themselves and gave Ethiopia to Italy. Italy came to invade Ethiopia. 80 tribes with different religions, multiple different types of languages, gathered. Some of them traveled for more than a month to fight against the Italians. They went to the battle at the Battle of Adwa in 1896, March 1st, defeated a modern Italian army, and Ethiopia became the only country that was never colonized in Africa.
Just a beautiful story.
Yeah, and this inspired Africans to fight for their independence. You know, the Africans were colonized by Europeans, fought for their independence. When they became independent, they adopted the color of Ethiopian flag as their flag of independence. In African Americans, Caribbeans, black people all over the world saw Ethiopia as a symbol of freedom. So the Rastafarian movement, Bob Marley, the Back to Africa movement, the Ethiopianism movement, all of this saw Ethiopia as a symbol of freedom. Now, in the last 15 years, there has been significant changes that happened. And I was alive, I was born in most of this time. So my book tries to explain, tries to narrate the sorrow and the beauty of Ethiopia and its change, and also my own change through that.
Well, it's a wonderful ambition. I can't wait to read the book. It'll do so much. You bring to an old and young country like Australia these perspectives, which of course resonate here, because Indigenous culture in Australia was for so long ignored, trampled. People did their best to marginalise it. People weren't allowed to speak their own languages. And there have been various attempts to bring justice to Indigenous people in Australia, and a measure has been achieved, perhaps not as much as some people would like. But we see revival of languages. We see positive steps to protect languages. And to look at your country, you're talking about 80 different ethnic groups going back. I'm assuming a lot of languages are still spoken in Ethiopia. What sort of numbers are we talking about?
More than 80 languages are spoken in Ethiopia still today. And the country, the very interesting thing is, and also the book features that, and also my studies also show that, modern people, however egalitarian we think we are less tolerant to diversity than older generations in the past. Because in modern way of thinking about, you know, politics or identity, when we organize them ourselves, especially from the period of what we call Enlightenment in Europe, we started to assume, to kind of feel like there is another outside world which is primitive, like the non-Western world in particular, was regarded as having no history to teach us, no knowledge to teach us. As a result of that, we created a framework, a hierarchy, on the basis of languages, cultures, and knowledges that excluded significant amount of the world's intellectual wealth from education, from developing our lives. We hurt ourselves by doing that, because we become simply clients of a kind of, you know, capitalist system that rules over our lives, that is nearly destroying our planet now because of climate change, nuclear war, and what have you. So for me, these old cultures are not just primitive, they are not dead, because they are alive. They allowed civilizations to exist. Before Western civilization, we had ancient civilizations. We have all kinds of civilizations that were in the past, and people still maintain their lives, their dignities, their history, their writing on the base of those. And those cultures, including the indigenous Australian culture and knowledge and history, is a resource of humanity, of all of us. You know, if we really go beyond our assumptions about identity and nation, and see ourselves as humans, we're all connected on how we try to adapt in this world in different circumstances. So my book is a way of trying to reach at that level of humanity that we share, and bring a story that tries to tell a different story, an Ethiopian experience, into the Australian context.
The development, or the progress, whatever word you want to use, progress is not always the best one, of humans on this planet fascinates most of us. Of course, when you see imperialism in its sort of its full glory, with the Spanish and the Portuguese going to South America originally, the Dutch coming to the Indonesian archipelago, the the British taking over large passages of Africa, Australia, you name it. And these days, we are looking at the effects of colonialism. And there are those who argue that not all of the effects of colonialism were bad, but for Indigenous peoples everywhere, they were certainly not good. And this notion that we need to go back and learn from Indigenous culture, as you say, for climate change, how did Aboriginal people in Australia look after the land? What lessons do we learn from that today? Presumably one of them is we don't want too much overproduction and over developing of land and water and the air so we can live. But is everything in the traditional culture sort of subject to protection? Mm. I'm fascinated, for example, brought up in a Western culture, about the role of women in society. I've got four granddaughters, and they're all keen to be good students and to study and to be active members of society. In Ethiopia, in a more traditional setting, what's the role of women? Are they at home, or are they in society? Are they in politics? Yeah. Are they in academia?
Yeah. You see, when we talk about the past or a traditional or ancient society, it doesn't mean to go back into the past. It means, you know, there are people who are living a life which is worthy of listening to, but we view it as a past life. In my writing and in my teaching, I call this the colonization of time. It's a colonization of time because people who are living in traditional indigenous cultures, they are often regarded as people who live in the past. And when they are referred to as people living in the past, we assume that that past is miserable. And the past they live in, we think, is a natural state of existence, but this is a past, this is a present created by us, by colonialism, so that they live in a miserable life, but we interpret it as a culture, as a natural outcome of their primitiveness, they are living in the past. And then we say, if they follow our life styles, if they speak our language, if they learn our education, their future will become our present. They will become like us. So these people are dispossessed of time, which means the future is our, somebody else's present, and their present is somebody else's past. And this type of reference really is difficult and also unproductive, because it makes us view the people, the rich culture that they have now, as a thing of the past. So I am not advocating for going to the past and living or doing all the rituals ancient people were doing. I am advocating for the life presently indigenous people, Africans, Asians, all other people are living and giving dignity and honor to their lives, because their language is not regarded as worthy. So if you go to Ethiopia, this brilliant country that wrote books before the British even had the alphabet, this great country that really was Christian before most Europeans were Christian and accepted multiculturalism, multi-religious refugees before most countries did, produced more than a million manuscripts in the Guz language, a lot of which is stolen. And one of my research is actually to trace back that in research, and I have done a lot of research on that. This country is not allowed to use its language in the education system to teach the children. In Ethiopia, education is in English. Out of the blue, the political system decided that Ethiopians should study in English. I was trained as a lawyer in Ethiopia. 99% of Ethiopians do not speak English.
And yet it's...
But when I go to university, my teachers speak the Amharic language, but they are made to teach me in English.
Well, it seems crazy.
It is crazy, but it is normalized. And everyone sees from the West. They don't see education as a weapon of colonialism, but it is a weapon of the colonizing the mind, because my fathers My ancestors cannot read the theses, the writings that their children are producing. So you see, education become a means of promoting ignorance by denying indigenous experiences and languages from education. Development is also become a process of producing poverty by taking land from the farmers and giving it to rich, wealthy investors in Ethiopia. Those farmers who fought colonialism, who maintained the country's tradition, they don't have a voice in the country's political system. That's why I call it a native colonial system. Politics become a means of creating and exasperating war and violence. The current modern elite has divided the people on the basis of ethnicity. In the past, ethnicity united them. They fought the Italians together. Now the current system, which is part of the Western system, they divided the people on the basis of their race. And if you remember the recent war in Tigray, Amhara now, Oromo, all these people, their identity become part of the modern political system. It is in the constitution, and they are made to fight against each other. So modernity, which is introduced, copied from the West by the elites, although it seems progressive, it's actually a violence against the people. It is colonialism. Education, you know, we have the right to education. We call education has to be a right. But in whose language education should be a right? Whose knowledge should become education? You know, Western education is a human right. Indigenous Ethiopian education is not regarded as education. A lot of Ethiopians' manuscripts are taken by museums and libraries all over the world, mistranslated by some professors who claim to have discovered new knowledge from Ethiopia, while Ethiopians are studying in a language they don't understand, in English. Books translated by Europeans from their own original language into English.
Well, your book, The Native Colonialism, I would understand, makes these points very deeply, and in many ways want to indigenize the education system in Ethiopia, taking into account that there are other different ethnic groups. I mean, you're a speaker of Amharic.
Yeah.
You've also got the Tigrayans, who have their language.
Yeah.
There's the formal language in which those old books were written, and I can never say it. How do you say
Giz,
it?
Giz, yeah.
Giz, it's yeah. G-E with a yeah. accent and then
yeah.
Z.
Yeah.
And I imagine not many people read that, let alone speak it. Am I right? But you yeah. find all those early ancient yeah. texts, and if yeah. you want to be educated, you need to have that language.
Yeah.
And yet English is the dominant system of the education.
Yeah, the English is the language, the medium, the curriculum that is supported by the World Bank, that is funded by the government. Because, you know, the education system is designed by copying from the West. And that happened after the Second World War, and Ethiopians started to have all these problems as a result.
Well, the United Nations was formed in 1948.
Yeah.
Australia and I think Ethiopia were founding members
yeah.
of the UN.
Absolutely.
The World Bank comes along more recently, but it's in the belief that economic development
yeah.
will relieve poverty and be good for everybody. But you're suggesting that's at least unthinking. It's not.
Because what we have to remember is the World Bank is a bank. What is the legitimate purpose of a bank? To make profit. When a bank designs policy, it designs that policy to be profitable for its own rate of return, right? So the World Bank has been designing education policies in Africa for a long time. And it says it is better to invest in primary education, make education mandatory, and a lot of investment goes. And not everything is bad, of course. People are able to read and write in many ways. But the outcome of that is that the education system itself, the content is foreign for local people. Mm. And also it focuses so much on the infrastructure, not on the content, and the thing that is, you know, essentially important for people. I just mentioned the World Bank as an example. I think
yes.
that, but just to show how it is connected with the global financial and political system, the Ethiopian system is. But the root cause of the problem is in the country when in 1974, the last emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, was overthrown and replaced by a military dictator. A new question emerged about who we are. The new leaders say the old system is reactionary. It is bad. It is backward. They were socialists or Marxists. Or they just, you know, said everybody in the past was bad. They killed many of those leaders. They take their land. And then after they do that, and how do we create this new country if everything in the past is bad? There are two proposals. One proposal says, we can come as a nation by creating class solidarity, which means all the people in Ethiopia are regarded as the oppressed class, and then let's create a socialist country that destroyed its feudalist past and move into the future. And some people say, but the people you say we are one class, we are divided by culture, we are divided by language. And how do we just come together as one? And they say, no, we can still work together as one, and let's create a one united government or Ethiopia. And in order to unify the people around this principle, they use violence. They invented national enemies, which are people related to the previous, the old monarchical system. So this idea ruled the country for 17 years. After 17 years, there were armed resistance against this brutal system. It was led by Eritreans and Tigrayans, the Tigray Liberation Front. And when the Derg was overthrown, all Ethiopians supported this group, but they had a particular ideology about creating a new Ethiopia. Again, they are the same in hating the past, but they want to create a new Ethiopia based on ethnicity. Now they say, you know, in the past, the old regime, the feudals, they were not just feudal class, they were Amhara. They picked one of the ethnic groups because the language, the common language of the old people were Amharic. Right? So because those people who now speak the Amharic language are the privileged people because of their language, they are connected with the leaders, so they are the enemies of all other ethnic groups in the country. And then the Amhara become the national enemy of all ethnic groups, created a constitution demonizing the Amhara people. And the Tigrayans ruled the country using this principle for 30 years. They are 6% minority. They created the Ethiopian's elite during that period. When they lose power recently, replaced by another more radical group against the Amhara, the Oromo Nationalist Movement, the Oromo Nationalist Movement even say, no, 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 the Amharas are not just oppressors, they are colonizers. Then they referred back to Minilik, back to old emperors who might have committed various acts, but not in the name of the Amharic-speaking people. They criminalize the Amharas, start to expel them, and now the current government is waging war in the Amhara region. Now, this whole process shows us the struggle to find meaning that unifies all people together. It didn't work without the history, without the culture. So the only thing that can work is to create enemies and friends. And Ethiopia entered into this tragic situation at the moment.
You mentioned those three main groups, the Tigray, Amharic, and the one
star. Oromo, yes.
Yes, there are many others, but...
Yeah.
Language can be used by people to define themselves and to distinguish themselves from others, in turn become hateful about others and fight over resources and country and who makes decisions in the country. And,
absolutely.
And I get the impression that's still happening in Ethiopia. Let's segue. It's not really a segue. Let's with that context, come back to your book.
Mm-hmm.
When it's published, and I assume it'll get published next year, it's going to tell a story about you being that shepherd boy. And that's a lovely poetic introduction to the book and to the writer and to the narrative. But you're going to take the story in various directions, aren't you? And the English reader will be able to read all of that in English.
Yeah.
And there will be interspersed in between the narrative the poems, originally written in that beautiful language, the traditional poetic language, and there'll be the English translations of it.
Yeah.
So what will the narrative do? And secondly, what will be the role of the poems?
Very good question. The book is organized into the four chapters of human life in the Ethiopian indigenous philosophy. Human beings are believed to have soul and flesh or body. The soul has three characteristics. It includes knowledge, lebbawinet, nebabinet, hayawinet, which is knowledge, language, and the ability to live forever. These are the characteristics of our soul. So our knowledge is our comes from our soul, our language comes from our soul, and we live forever because of our soul. And our body is has four characteristics. The characteristics of the wind, which is childhood, from birth to around year 20. The characteristics of fire, from 20 to 40. The characteristics of water, from 40 to about 60, and the characteristics of soil, then soil or from 60 onwards. Now, the wind is childhood, the fire is when we become young, and you know, this division of life is so important because people treat each other by understanding their behavior to act in this way. When at the wind stage, children are meant to be free. At the fire stage, young people or adults are meant to be strong. They are strong, but they could be also dangerous. At the water stage, they are meant to be reflective, calm. So if you see, you know, 23-year-old or 30-year-olds fighting on the street, the older people have the duty to go and reconcile them. The younger ones will immediately listen to them, because in their understanding, water extinguishes fire. They are fighting, but the waters, the ones who are older, have, you know, the authority to resolve anything. And the last stage is a time when people start to go more to church and start to pray more, and that time is the time of, you know, ending their life, and it does. That is how human life is organized. That's how people, they live their lives in that indigenous philosophy. So my book goes into my wind life. It narrates my fire life. It also shows how I'm going through the water stage.
You're not old enough to be in the water stage.
Water stage, I'm 47, so.
Getting close.
Yeah, so, you know, it tells that. And all that narrative is intercepted by poetry. And the poems reflect how I lived, because I wrote my poems from young age up to the present.
You've been able to bring
So I'm able to bring in those poems.
Which is lovely.
Because also poem is regarded as the highest literature in Ethiopia. It's the expression of our inner voice, which is the voice of the soul. We call writing poetry samana work, which means
wax. That's an Amharic word.
Which means wax and gold.
Wax and gold.
Yeah. The wax is the surface meaning of the poem. The gold is the inner meaning of the poem, and every poem needs to have multiple meanings.
The poems that you've included for the book will cover what sorts of topics? Will it cover the four stages that you've described, or will it be trying to convey other pieces of gold?
It does. Once people, you know, the main purpose of the book is not necessarily just poetry. It is memoir, right? It tells the history of a country, but it uses poetry in it. So the poem actually shows the inner voice of myself, and also I believe the soul of my country, how my country is experiencing those sufferings, those griefs or utterances during all this period of my life. So it includes all of that. It includes, it also takes into account the Australian reader and how it can be understood. And because I am an academic, I've been researching and teaching for more than 10 years, 16 years of research, and before that in Ethiopia also. So I have knowledge of both worlds, and I believe we don't live in one world. We live in multiple worlds. And those worlds are contained by language. The languages we have are like the blueprint of different worlds. So I'm able to translate meanings and experiences from one world, the Ethiopian world, to the Australian world, thanks to my academic training, but at the same time also my creative writing gift, which I tend to use quite often. So I have published short stories, poems in the past, which people can check. And also I'm so grateful and excited to have this, to have won the Hungerford.
Well, it's going to be really, really interesting to read it. And you've answered the question I was going to ask, who the intended audience is. I mean, it's been published by Fremantle Press. The judges have recognised this, well, the expression's often misused, but this multicultural aspect to it. It's teaching us things in Australia about Australian culture by being able to look across the Indian Ocean and over the top of Somalia into Ethiopia and taking account of the history and the narrative and your history and these poems. What about the people in Ethiopia? I imagine people are going to read this book with great interest.
Yeah, I hope so. It is written for both, but what I also see is I don't see myself just as an Ethiopian.
No.
I'm Australian, This is my country. When I come to this country, I'm not here just to speak English and to learn the Western culture. I'm here with my culture. I'm here to also share and transmit my culture, my experience to my children, because it embodies so many wisdoms and important messages for the world. So you see, a multicultural society has to be multilingual, and it needs different ways of living, expressing oneself, so that our children can have the option to invent, create new things out of the multiple diverse things that we allow to exist on this land. And we will be a very closed society if we want people but do not like their culture, do not like their language, do not like what they bring from their experiences, because we simply turn them into things, into people without meaning and history. And that is really colonial and unhealthy for our future. So for me, what I see being an Australian is someone who belongs to this country with my culture, with my identity. If this country cannot accept my culture and my language, that means I'm not part of this country. I cannot be who I am without that experience, that language, that culture. And so I'm not trying to really necessarily appease or reach out to particular audiences. I'm trying to express a genuine Ethiopian experience and also a journey of my own transformation. I never knew I was a black man until I come to Australia. I never thought that how I look has anything to do to describe what type of person I might be. It is only when I came and kind of felt the gaze of other people on me, and I started to imagine what they might be thinking about me, and I start to learn how they are taught about blackness and what black people look like, and I start to see that meaning. It's only after that that I started to relate my Ethiopian rich experience to the experience of black people. Before that, I never thought my history, my culture as black culture, as black experience.
It's just
an Ethiopian human experience. But because in this country and in other countries, we have racism. Racism is not individual feeling or prejudice, but racism is when you have a culture,
a history that make us feel differently for how different races look like to us. Without talking to them, without examining them, we just have a feeling about who they are, who might they be. That kind of imposed feeling is what is kind of historically inherited racism means. And in order to challenge that, in order to make ourselves great people or great persons that embrace diversity, we need to listen to this type of stories. They are absolutely critical to understand, to challenge how we live and how we think about others. And in the process of doing that, we also change ourselves.
Igor, I personally can't wait to read the book, and I know many others will. I'm told Amharic is a very difficult language to speak and learn.
Yeah.
I guess it isn't for you because you grew up with it.
Yeah, Amharic is a beautiful language. My son, which is 5 years old, my wife don't speak Amharic. She's a white Australian. So my son always speaks to me in Amharic, and wonderful. I talk to him in Amharic only. It's so beautiful to see him speaking and also reciting some of the poems that I do. It's beautiful. So languages are really, we have a saying which says, language is a god that hides in human flesh. The power of language is the ability to create a world. When I talk about Ethiopia, you don't go there, you can't see it, but you somehow imagine something using that language. Language creates a world. Destroying a language is destroying another world. Saving a language is saving a world. And that world is so important. That's why I'm passionate about languages.
Now, one thing I understand that Ethiopian people, all of them are passionate about, is Ethiopian bread. Do you pronounce it injera?
Injera, yes.
I gather just about everything is made with injera.
Yes.
And does injera survive here in Australia?
Of course. There are injeras. Actually, I also eat injera at home. I suppose there is one restaurant, Lalibela restaurant, which people can go to.
Lalibela being a part of...
Lalibela. Lalibela is a name of a holy place. Yes. Actually, I was born at this place called Lalibela.
And it's a beautiful name. It's spelled L-A-L-I-B-E-L-A, Lalibela.
Yes, Lalibela.
It almost sounds Italian.
Yeah, and if I say one thing about Lalibela, this is where I was born. And there was this rock as big as a village, like a suburb. Big rock. And from this rock, they started to carve this rock from the roof, from the top, and carve it down and created 11 beautiful churches out of a single rock.
They're very famous,
Ethiopians,
aren't they?
In the 13th century, that is Lalibela. Mm. Wow. And the tunnels, underground waterways, that is where I grew up, studying from the monks. And that beautiful place, Ethiopia, I mean Lalibela, reflects the type of civilization, the type of wisdom that is being destroyed now in the name of modernization, in the name of, you know, bringing Western knowledge, bringing Western language. I'm not against Western knowledge. It is so important for all of us. I'm not against Western languages, but, you know, Ethiopians need to study English, but they don't need to write their history, everything in English. Because the English world also needs Ethiopian languages. We don't want them to die out. We don't want to go everywhere in the world and see a world that is just speaking only one language, does only one kind of culture, like McDonald's and so on, and we don't see all those beautiful cultures. If they die out, you know, everyone, all of us are harmed by that. So that's why I'm really passionate about cultural diversity. It is not destroying who we are, it's enriching, transforming who we are, making us better, because we have the option to select what works for us.
Yiriga, it's been lovely talking to you. How do I say thank you in Amharic?
Amasagnalo.
Say it again.
Amasagnalo.
I'm saying that to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been delightful talking to you.
Thank you for having me. this time with me as well. Thanks.